This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, are you a procrastinator? Procrastination, the human tendency to delay. 20% of us are procrastinators. A third of all American undergraduates call themselves severe procrastinators, and a staggering 100 minutes of every workday are squandered away by those employees in the workforce. Could procrastination really only stem from laziness? You may think otherwise when you factor in that so many of our greatest inventors, artists, and scientists are considered members of this procrastinators club. In his new book called Soon, author Andrew Santella offers up a very entertaining and thought-provoking exploration of procrastination and some of history's most notable procrastinators, from Leonardo da Vinci to Frank Lloyd Wright. Andrew Santella, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, I have to say that I was a little surprised to know that only 20% of us are procrastinators. I thought that basically all of us, you know, with a very few exceptions, procrastinated at least from time to time.
That's just in your circle, Lynn.
I agree, and that's one of the lessons of my book is that boy, what a universal or nearly universal habit it is. It's just such a basic human impulse, and I felt so much less alone in my habit after working on this book, and a little less bad about my habit too.
Well, that's good. You know, I think you make this argument, and I've certainly always tried to make it, that, you know, there's bad procrastination that's really unproductive and time-wasting and soul-sucking, and then there is procrastination that is, you know, skillful prioritization. So what do you say about that?
The trick is to know which is which, and sometimes, boy, we're very good at fooling ourselves and deluding ourselves, and that's one of the basic skills of any true procrastinator is, you know, self-deception and delusion. And, you know, I think that procrastination is one of those sorts of, it can be one of those, you know, ways of sort of navigating a chaotic life or sort of feeling like we have some sort of control over our lives. You know, we all need to feel that sense of control, and sometimes putting something off and sort of willfully delaying something helps us to feel like we're a little bit in control. Although, you know, that too is a little bit of a delusion, because, you know, the delay is also the things that it also adds to the stress that we feel later and to the more chaos in our lives. So it's one of the many paradoxes of procrastination, I think.
If procrastination is sort of one of those elemental features of human nature, then why do we tag it with so many negative connotations? Why not just embrace procrastination and build a system around our human nature, as opposed to trying to fit our human nature into a system?
Yeah, I think you've hit on something really important there, and that's one of the cases I try to make in the book, is for a greater tolerance for procrastination. Procrastinators of the world, unite, eventually. But yeah, no, it is a basic and understandable impulse. We're all sort of divided within ourselves. We all have, you know, the slacker within us and the diligent person within us, and we're all sort of pulled in multiple directions, and all those sorts of elements of our personality are fighting it out. You know, there's a lot of it's also connected to some really basic and understandable, you know, fears and anxieties in our lives. The projects that maybe matter to us the most and where we feel that we have the most at stake are the ones we often end up putting off.
What does basic procrastination look like? You know, when do you know it when you see it, or are you able to describe it in a way that makes sense to people and they go, oh, that's exactly what procrastination is?
Yeah, so when we talk about procrastination sort of every day, we often are just talking about it as another word for delay, putting something off, and that's fine. I think most of us understand it that way, but the researchers and social scientists who look into this sort of thing professionally insist on a little bit more rigorous definition, and the difference is that their definition is that it's putting off a necessary or required task, knowing that that delay will come back to bite you eventually. So that last bit, the bit about knowing that your delay is going to harm you, is the added and crucial element that makes something procrastination. And I guess the distinction matters because there are, they would say, things that you can legitimately delay and reasonably delay putting off doing that wouldn't qualify as procrastination because there's good reason to delay doing that. If I know that I owe you money by next Sunday, and I don't think I do, by the way, but if I know that I owe you money by next Sunday, but that there's a good chance that debt will be forgiven sometime in the interim, yeah. Well, then it's not procrastination for me to hold off paying you back. It's just good sense and reasonableness. So that's the difference there, and that's the distinction between ordinary and reasonable delay and procrastination.
Well, along those lines of reason, then, you talk in your book about a lot of creative types, artists, and you know, even yourself, a writer, who procrastinate. And if you knew that if you delayed something until there were a deadline looming, and that would spark somehow your creativity, would you continue to put it off? And I think that, you know, you probably argue that yes.
Yeah, well, and that idea that, boy, I work best under pressure is such a common one. It's one I hear all the time, and I'm sure you have too. And it's probably one I've tried to trot out every once in a while. But again, like researchers like dispute that and say that there really is no good reason to believe that people work better under pressure. So it's one of those puzzles about procrastination. But you know, to talk about creative people and about writers in particular are the worst and most shameless procrastinators. And I say that as a professional writer, I'm ashamed of my colleagues. But it's one of those fields of work where you can get away with saying, "Oh, I need to wait for inspiration," or whatever, you know, that cliche, which is not something, say, your car mechanic would get away with. He can't say, "I'll get to that oil change, but I need to take a soulful, meditative walk on the beach first." That just wouldn't work. But it's a little bit of a mystery to me why we let writers get away with that.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Andrew Santella. He is an admitted procrastinator, but I think maybe he's a recovering procrastinator. His book is called Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination, from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. So, well, let's talk about some of these cases, these famous cases of procrastination. Frank Lloyd Wright, for example, and his famous house, Falling Water. He was supposed to do it. I forget the timeline. He ended up, tell us about it. He ends up designing it in like 2 hours.
Well, so that's the legend. Yeah, the legend is that his client had asked him to get to work on this home that, you know, we know now as one of the landmarks in architectural history. And apparently Wright, like, didn't do a whole lot immediately, or at least didn't put a whole lot down on paper immediately. And it was only when his client let him know that, hey, I'm going to be stopping by the studio tomorrow, and I'd love to see those drawings you've been working on, and that Wright had to actually get to work really fast and try to produce some drawings. And it's a really great story, one that resonates, I think, with all of us procrastinators. But the problem is it might not exactly be true. I think what happened was that his sort of Wright's students, his admirers, kind of spread this legend about him, which is sort of funny because it's not the sort of thing you might think one would want to brag about, waiting until the last minute to do something for your client wouldn't necessarily be great for your professional reputation. But I think for rights admirers, they saw this as sort of this legend they like to spread as an example of, his genius. He was operating on a plane so far above most people that he was able to just sort of produce brilliant work on demand at the last moment.
Andrew, is there a pattern between left and right brain? It sounds like, writers have created this mythology around how procrastination benefits them. And now architects, also creative types, and they're given projects, right? There's sort of a project component to it. Here's this project, go off and work on it, and I'll check up on you 6 months from now and see how you're doing. And that builds in the opportunity, the window of opportunity for a great deal of procrastination. So is it the system, or is it the side of the brain that's being used, or is there any pattern that you found by looking at all these amazing people throughout history who are great procrastinators, prolific procrastinators?
I think you've hit on something there, that idea of the project that we can delay sometimes. You go into any coffee shop in any big city in the world now, and there's this workforce of independent contractors out there tapping away at their laptops, and they are not on, not answerable to the boss. Maybe immediately they're working on some sort of contract basis on some long-term project, or maybe not working on that long-term project right at the moment. They might be putting it off, and I think that contract sort of gig economy that has developed, in the recent years, really, really feeds our natural impulse to procrastinate.
Well, the gig economy is an opportunity to procrastinate. Doing your taxes is probably a great opportunity to procrastinate. And I'm wondering, again, looking at the people throughout history that you've found. Without a gig economy and before taxes, and which gave a great opportunity, who was one of your favorite stories other than Frank Lloyd Wright, because we already talked about his house, but who else stands out as one of those people who found a way to procrastinate and really intrigued and piqued your interest?
The person that I came to admire the most in working on the book was Charles Darwin, a guy who, indisputably influential thinker, whose ideas changed the way we see the world, but also, just like me and maybe like you, someone who could put off the work that he had to do and could procrastinate. Darwin developed the ideas behind natural selection fairly early in his life, sometime early 1830s. And proceeded to do something kind of funny. He kind of just set it aside, even though he knew he was onto something big there and something that people had been sort of nibbling around the edges of. But even though he knew he was onto something, he didn't rush to publish it. Instead, he went off and spent the next more than two decades doing other things and kind of things that seem a little odd to us. He got obsessed with barnacles, these little sea creatures. He worked on them obsessively for years, to the point where these little creatures almost took over the Darwin household. There's a really great story about one of Darwin's kids thinking that every house was like that, that they were like jars of pickled barnacles in every room. And he went off to visit a friend at his friend's house once and said, where are all the barnacles? Where does your father do his barnacles? He thought that everyone lived like Charles Darwin did. It might seem like he was wasting his time with all these little private obsessions that he was working on instead of developing his big idea. But the thing is that I think eventually the insights he gained from those little obsessions, from the barnacles, from the earthworms, ended up feeding his big idea, or at least informing his big idea. And so it's kind of hard to separate the two. And it's really rich story about delay and what we can learn from, you know, the things we choose to do.
Well, maybe Darwin, did you explore the possibility that it was really a rational decision on his part to not challenge the religious structures of the day and spend his time whiling away on barnacles instead? That could have prolonged his life by about 20 or 30 years also.
Right. I mean, there was a lot at work there. It's hard to sort of piece together what his motivations might have been. I mean, certainly there's also the matter of he was a diligent scientist, and science does take time. I mean, you don't just crank it out. I think to his credit, he wanted to fully develop his ideas and do the math and check the numbers and all that, and that's to be admired. But I think, you know, the more than two decades that he spent, you have to acknowledge that there was other things at work, and I think he was ambivalent about challenging the ideas of his time and challenging challenging religious establishment, for that matter. His father was a minister, and his wife was a devout believer, and these people mattered an awful lot to him. And I think that that ambivalence was certainly at work there.
Mm. Leonardo da Vinci, a great procrastinator. Talk about him.
Yeah, so he's another person who's interests were so varied, and his intellect like so energetic that he was pulled in a million different directions, often to his often to his harm. You know, we think of him as a genius now, of course, and a, you know, ultimate Renaissance man. But to his contemporaries, or at least to a lot of his contemporaries, he was sort of a joke, a guy who never could get projects done. Mm-hmm. Michelangelo loved to needle Leonardo about his inability to finish projects, and the problem was that there was too much going on. There's too much intellectual percolation going on there. He would be commissioned to do a portrait by some patron of his, and he might start on it, but in the meantime, he would get onto maybe some anatomical study that he was interested in, or some fantastic machine that, you know, he wanted to sketch out and develop. There was always something else turning his head and attracting his attention, so that it was sometimes hard for him to finish things. He, you know, finished only 20 paintings in his lifetime. Great artist of history, but not a prolific one.
Mm. Yeah, he was one of those micro masters. I like that.
Yeah.
So in your research for writing this book soon, how were you able to recognize your own self-deception and delusion when it comes to procrastinating? And how did you sort of deliver yourself out of it, keep the helpful?
Or have you?
Yeah, or have you?
Yeah, right.
We're making some assumptions here.
You're assuming the best about me. The whole project, I mean, to be perfectly honest, the whole project was a little bit delusional. I started, you know, hoping that if I just dug into the history deep enough that I would find some way to justify my habit. You know, that I might find some kernel of research that would excuse me and excuse my procrastination.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the ultimate self, you know, the ultimate act of rationalization and self-justification. But, in terms of whether I changed, I think what I learned was that I'm a little bit ashamed to say this, to be honest. I think I learned that I'm not quite the great procrastinator that I thought I was.
Aw, you had this whole story.
Like a lot of procrastinators, I take a little sort of perverse pride in my bad habit. And, you know, you often hear people say, oh, I'm the world's worst procrastinator. I'm a terrible procrastinator. We're both ashamed of the habit and a little bit proud of it and want to brag about it. But I think what I learned in the course of writing the book was that there's a very strong part of me that gets things done on time and is diligent about things. And I guess nobody's perfect.
Oh, you're going to have to write another book.
Right.
The Power of Highly Organized Time Management.
Right.
And how about your readers? What's your hope for people who pick up soon and read it? What do you want them to walk away with?
I want them to know that, you know, certainly that they're not alone, and that it's a very, if they are procrastinators, they are in good company, and it's a fairly human impulse. I want them to have a little fun. I hope they have fun with the book. I certainly had fun writing it, and I hope they feel a little less bad about their habit and enjoy getting to know some of the other great minds in history who have shared their habit.
That's a nice thought for just about everybody, is to, you know, Lynn and I were talking about this yesterday, about taking ourselves too seriously. If we can just inject a little humor into almost everything, even procrastination, it sort of takes the edge off of it, and you can accept yourself a little more easily, and other people also. Foibles, the foibles of yourself and others.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think a big part of this book is sort of a plea for tolerance of procrastination. We're stop being so hard on each other and hard on yourselves for your habit, because it is a pretty understandable human impulse.
And you will get those taxes filed.
Eventually. You know, I just want to make one last comment or question, and that is, I found this little book in cleaning out my bookshelf. I found this little book about feng shui, and it was talking about the clutter that we have in our lives and the clutter that leads to, you know, more procrastination and even depression. And clearing out the clutter in your life will, you know, create the feng shui that we all so desperately want and need. But it makes me think about when those bills come in, or that the paper comes in the mail, and you know, there's never really anything that I want that comes from my mailbox. So I put it aside, and then pretty soon it's clutter, and I've procrastinated on it. And there are those things that you probably found that generally, if people procrastinate on, they would love to eradicate from their lives.
Right. Right, yeah, you talk about clutter, and I mean, that's so much a part of all of our lives, and not just like physical clutter, but I mean just like all the information that's coming at us constantly. There's like never-ending stream deluge of information that kind of creates, I don't know, like digital clutter, maybe, I don't know, but but it's hard to deal with. And you know, there are two competing ways to conceptualize procrastination that professionals use, and one is to think about it in terms of these outside environmental challenges that have to be managed. You know, the deadlines, the clutter, all the time pressures. That's outside. The other way to conceptualize it is as the procrastination originating inside of each of us, that is in the moods or emotions that we have to manage, or that we fail to regulate. And I find like that second idea, that the issue is inside of us, the more compelling one. Mm-hmm. I think too often the procrastination comes out of this idea that, well, there will be a better time for me to do this. I'll feel more like doing it another time. There will be a perfect moment to do this when I'll feel more inspired later. And of course, you know, there often is no perfect moment. And the thing that will put us, it's ironic, but the thing that will put us in the mood to do our work is often doing the work. The problem is that's the one thing, you know, you just can't imagine yourself doing sometimes.
That's right. The book is Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination, from Leonardo and Darwin to you and me. Our guest is Andrew Santella.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Great.